The docket today, Appeal 08-2441, Brian Mead versus National City Corporation. Mr. Dubofsky, welcome back again. It just seems like you're here every week.
It only feels that way, Your Honor.
It feels that way. How many times have you argued in the last,
generally,
2 months here?
Generally about four times a year, Your Honor.
Yeah, but it's been about four times in the last 2 months, hasn't it?
It has been, Your Honor, and you've had the good fortune of drawing me.
I've had the honor of being on the panel every time.
Actually, I've had the good fortune of drawing you. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mark Dubofsky, and I represent Brian Mead in this case. In addition to the issue of the plan's refusal to consider the additional evidence that we submitted, the Social Security decision and the neuropsychological report, an issue that I plan to get back to address, there were at least five defects in National City's denial of Brian Mead's disability benefits. The first is the plan's failure to consider all grounds that were presented. Dr. Tillery's report indicated that Mr. Mead was disabled due to, and I quote, mental status and depression, concentration ability, and communicative limitations, as well as the need for frequent physical repositioning, chronic pain, and his need for ongoing pain medication. The plan gave no consideration to the first part of that opinion, the mental status and depression, concentration, and communicative limitations. Second, the plan's decision relied only on the plan's doctors and gave no consideration whatsoever to Brian Mead's evidence. And even though doctors who the plan relied on ignored much of the significant evidence that was presented, there was no mention in any document reviewing Mr. Mead's claim of the report that was prepared by Dr. Nalini Sehgal from the University of Wisconsin, who diagnosed whiplash, myofascial pain, and a chronic pain disorder, and identified specific clinical objective findings that supported her opinion and suggested that an underlying facet or disc-mediated pain disorder cannot be excluded. What the plan did by ignoring this evidence violates the directive from the Supreme Court in the MetLife versus Glenn case, which says that plans are not permitted to focus solely on evidence that would defeat a claim, but must consider all of the evidence submitted in the claim file. And with respect to the ultimate decision that was made, the final decision on March 8, 2007, states as its rationale that there is no documented objective reason that when Mr. Mead's LTD claim was denied, he had an impairment level that would indicate he could not perform his work, which is sedentary with minimal physical demands. Review of radiological tests does not indicate acute objective findings, and his complaints are subjective. This is precisely the type of rationale that this court has deemed invalid under ERISA in both the Hawkins case and in the Diaz case. And it's simply wrong, because the plan disregarded the clinical evidence that I just mentioned. Dr. Sehgal's findings, the physical therapist's findings, such as Mr. Tupta's findings, physical therapist from the University of Wisconsin, who is completely ignored. Gordon Green's findings, the findings of every other physician who had examined Mr. Mead, Dr. Mull, Dr. Alexander.
Can I ask you just to go back to our standard of review in a case like this?
Yes.
Arbitrary and capricious, or abuse of discretion?
In the Glenn decision, the Supreme Court only used the term abuse of discretion. And there is
really that kind of a conflict of interest situation like was present in that MetLife case.
This is a conflict of interest situation, just as was present in the MetLife case, and for exactly the same reasons. This is a plan that both makes the decision and is responsible for paying the benefits.
But the problem was in MetLife, the company didn't even give the examiners all the relevant evidence. We don't have that situation here, do we?
On the contrary, we do have that here as well. We have to assume that the complete failure to mention Dr. Sehgal, the physiatrist from the University of Wisconsin, and to mention Mr. Tupta, the physical therapist who worked with Dr. Segal, is an indication that the plan did not consider or give their claim reviewers all of the evidence. Now, admittedly, Dr. Segal and Mr. Tupta came on the scene after Dr. Soriano had examined Mr. Mead. But Dr. Soriano explicitly stated in his report that his opinions would be subject to change if additional evidence was adduced, yet he was never asked to consider the additional evidence. Dr. Hoffman, the doctor who participated in the claim appeal, listed the evidence that he reviewed. And interestingly, he only reported part of Dr. Tillery's report and did not mention Dr. Segal or Mr. Tupta at all, which should give the court a pretty good indication that those reports were never supplied to Dr. Hoffman. And on top of that, Dr. Hoffman's report was conclusory and relied solely on Dr. Soriano's findings. In fact, Dr. Soriano effectively became the plan administrator in this case, whereas the plan had the fiduciary responsibility under the Glenn decision to apply a higher-than-marketplace duty to assure accurate claim processing, a duty that they completely ignored. And finally, the decision referenced Mr. Mead's ability to perform a sedentary job. But again, they asked the wrong question or decided the wrong issue. The issue was not whether Mr. Mead could perform a sedentary job. Mr. Mead's benefits were terminated while he was within the own occupation period under the plan. Mr. Mead's occupation was a bank manager responsible for originating and processing millions of dollars of mortgages a year, a highly cognitive job. Yet no consideration at all at any time was given by the plan to any of the cognitive issues which every single doctor mentioned, including Dr. Soriano, who did make some mention that Mr. Mead's wife had to read the instructions to him, and Mr. Mead was slow in responding to questions. Dr. Soriano also noted diminished range of motion in the neck, yet he seemed so biased to conclude that there was no neurological evidence supporting his claim that he just dismissed everything. And again, Dr. Segal's report becomes very important, because Dr. Segal also admitted or acknowledged that there were no neurological deficits. But she did find musculoskeletal abnormalities and indicated a potential cause for the condition, which the plan never considered, even though it was spelled out in her report.
You're getting pretty far into your rebuttal time. But
let me just mention the one issue before I sit down, and that's the issue of the refusal to consider additional evidence. And this, too, dovetails with Glenn. With Glenn's imposition of a higher-than-marketplace duty to assure accurate claim processing, to refuse to consider the Social Security finding after they had directed Mr. Mead to apply for those benefits, and to refuse to consider other persuasive evidence that did not exist earlier, is clearly a violation of their fiduciary duty.
Does the plan have a set-off for Social Security?
It does. Benefits?
So their obligations were reduced when he qualified as totally disabled by the Social Security.
Which is why they directed Mr. Mead to apply. I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Just before you sit down, it's not mentioned, but was there any type of personal injury lawsuit that was filed in connection with this auto accident?
There is a mention of that, Your Honor. In one of the medical records, I believe it was Dr. Mansell's, one of Dr. Mansell's records, he mentioned something along the lines of the lawsuit had been settled the week before he came to see him. So there was no other litigation pending.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Cleveland.
Good morning. Let me begin by addressing the subject of the burden of proof. It is
Standard review
of the claims appeals committee's decision. The standard of review here is arbitrary and capricious or abuse of discretion. I'm not sure that the words make a great difference in terms of the formulation or the ultimate outcome of this case. The MetLife decision, to which the parties refer in their briefs, we submit does not change this court's applicable standard of review for these sorts of cases at all. Indeed, subsequent decisions of this court apply the standard the same way it had been applied prior to the MetLife case, and other courts of appeals decisions, some of which we have cited in our brief, apply it in the same way as well. Applying that standard, the decision here easily passes muster as not being an abuse of discretion. The arguments that have been made to challenge the decision here this morning simply don't withstand analysis. Firstly, the argument is asserted that not all of Mr. Mead's cognitive impairments, as they are called, were considered throughout the course of this case. Review of the opinion of Dr. Soriano shows that he did indeed review voluminous documentation reporting that Mr. Mead complained of cognitive impairments. Dr. Hoffman's report following the initial decision that Mr. Mead was not disabled similarly refers to the opinion of Dr. Tillery and other subsequently submitted materials, all purporting to establish that Mr. Mead was cognitively impaired. Furthermore, Dr. Soriano examined Mr. Mead, determined that Mr. Mead had a normal neurological examination, determined that there were no clinical abnormalities disclosed by his examination. Furthermore, Dr. Soriano made certain observations regarding Mr. Mead's condition, some of which were, for example, that Mr. Mead, while in the exam room, walked in a halting or struggling fashion, but as he walked to his car in the parking lot, moved fluidly and without restraint. He further observed that Mr. Mead said that he could watch his children's basketball games, drive a car, but that was inconsistent from a medical perspective with Mr. Mead's reported inability to read for 2 or 3 minutes without undergoing vertigo. Dr. Soriano, based on his review of the record and his examination, concluded that there was no evidence that Mr. Mead suffered from a disability as defined in the terms of the plan. That initial decision was indeed, based on that examination and its review of the record, it was initially determined that Mr. Mead was, in fact, not disabled under the terms of the plan. Mr. Mead appealed, submitted additional information. The case was referred to Dr. Hoffman, who did not solely rely on Dr. Soriano's report as asserted, but Dr. Hoffman reviewed the record himself. He said he reviewed over 800 pages of medical documentation. He also spoke with Dr. Barnhart, who was one of Mr. Mead's treating physicians. Based on his review of that documentation, Dr. Hoffman reached the same conclusion that Dr. Soriano had, namely that Mr. Mead did not have a disability as defined in the plan. The appeal committee, the final decision maker here, reached that same conclusion. The appeals committee decision states, again, first of all, that the standard is applicable here is the first two-year period, namely whether Mr. Mead could perform his own job, and decides that Mr. Mead did not meet that standard. There's nothing in the decision of the appeal committee that purports to be limited to a sedentary type position, as was asserted. The argument that was made here this morning and is made in the briefs by appellant, in essence, would force these sorts of decisions to fall into a mode that it strikes me as somewhat like the local Rule 56 in the Northern District of Illinois. Namely, each bit of evidence that might be submitted by a claimant here has to be specifically responded to, or else the decision will not withstand analysis. That's not what ERISA is about, and that is not what the standard of abuse of discretion or arbitrary and capricious review is about. What the test is whether or not the decision here being challenged is rationally based. I believe that the record shows that it is rationally based. Let me also address the matter of the material submitted after the appeal. After the appeal was rendered that Mr. Mead was not disabled, the 5.5 months later, I believe, it's in the briefs, additional materials were submitted with the request that the decision be reconsidered. It was not reconsidered. That decision is, first of all, consistent with the terms of the plan, which says the appeals committee decision is final. It's also consistent with the case law of this court. We have cited multiple cases from this court holding that the material to be considered on a review of this sort is the material before the plan, and that there's before the plan at the time the committee makes its decision, not materials later submitted. Now, furthermore, as we also have pointed out, and I don't think there's ever been a response to this, the result of allowing a claimant to continually submit materials after an appeal has been decided would be that there's never a final decision, because the applicable statute of limitations to a review of a claim such as this in Illinois is 10 years. So it would allow a claimant to continually toll the statute by repeatedly submitting additional materials, which is inconsistent, again, with the notion of finality and also inconsistent with the position with the decisions of this court. I will conclude and rest on the briefs unless the court has any questions about anything I've said or anything in our briefs. Thank you.
Thank you.
The concern expressed by counsel about a never-ending process if the plan were forced to consider additional evidence is simply a red herring. The evidence has to relate to the date on which the claimant alleged to be disabled. So if the claimant submits evidence that relates to a car accident that occurs 2 years later, it's not going to have any bearing. The concern expressed by counsel is really no concern at all. What we're talking about here is fairness. We're talking about evidence that could not have been submitted or obtained any earlier. And the cases that counsel relies on were all decided prior to the Glenn decision, which significantly raises the bar and also needs to be taken into consideration with the Supreme Court's Unum versus Ward case, where the identical argument was made and the court said in dictum, no, that would enhance the process by encouraging more accurate claim decisions. With respect to the standard of review, arbitrary and capricious or abuse of discretion, one thing that I think we can all agree upon is that the Supreme Court stated in the State Farm case that we cited in our brief that entirely ignoring an aspect of the problem is an abuse of discretion or arbitrary and capricious. And contrary to what counsel said, there was no consideration whatsoever given to the cognitive impairments, and there was no consideration whatsoever given to Dr. Segal's report. And while not every piece of evidence has to be considered, that was quite a significant report that was submitted on appeal and had to have been considered by the plan. For those reasons, we urge the court to reverse the decision below and reinstate Mr. Mead's benefits. Thank you.
Thank you. The case will be taken under advisement. We'll proceed to